Blog Talk Radio.
You have tuned in to the Brain Injury Radio Network with shows 7 nights a week. You can find the network at braininjuryradio.com or look up Brain Injury Radio Network on Facebook.
Another Fork in the Road with your host, Donna O'Donnell Fugerski.
Hi, welcome to the Brain Injury Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. My name is Donna O'Donnell Fugerski, and I am your host on my show, Another Fork in the Road. My show airs on the first and third Sundays of every month at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time. So if you're in different time zones, you just need to do the math and sort it out. So if you're in Eastern time zone, it's 8:30. If you are out in Hawaii, I have no idea what time you are. If you're earlier than we are right now, I know that. So yeah, so just make the conversions and tune in each 2 weeks. So the first and third Sunday of every month. Another sport in the world is for anyone. It's for anyone with a brain injury, anyone who's caring for a brain injured person, or anyone with any interest in learning more about brain injury. And frankly, I think that's an important thing to learn about, because brain injury is not discriminating. And it can happen to anyone, anytime, and anywhere. And it does. It does so often. The Brain Trauma Foundation states that there are more than 5 million people in the United States, just the United States, living with some form of brain injury. But most folks do not even know about it. I know that I never did, not until it came to live on my doorstep, and that happened in 2005, so I'm well aware of brain injury in my life now. On another fork in the road, I try to raise awareness of brain injury and to help folks understand what survivors and caregivers experience. On the third Sunday of each month, I interview brain injury survivors or caregivers to see how they traverse their world of brain injury. I host therapists, medical professionals, and authors to gain insight into what they offer survivors. And on each first Sunday of the month, I host a discussion panel to examine pertinent topics related to brain injury, such as depression, neurofatigue, anger, and various other symptoms of brain injury. And believe me, there are many, too many. We're going to be talking about some of them tonight. Not all of them, obviously, because I said too many. For those of you who are new to my show, here's just a little snippet about me. I came on the brain injury scene in 2005 when my husband David had a brain injury. You can learn more about that on my blog. And this is always the spot of the show I remember to tell people, have a pencil and paper nearby so you can jot down information, because I will be offering some URLs, some websites, some information of some sort to you during the show. And so you can learn again more about me and my husband David's brain injury on survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. That's my blog that I do tons and tons of stuff about brain injury, interviewing survivors and the caregivers. This show will later in the week be posted on that website too, under On the Air show menu. I shared David's and my story in 4 episodes on this very show, starting in August of 2014. And the last of which in November of 2014 featured a discussion with David. So that we got his point of view alongside my point of view, because although brain injury is happening to the one person, it really is affecting everyone in the family. So you get different points of view on it. And I think that was really important to know, not only my point of view, but also David's. Let's see. You can find all of my archived shows on my blog, again, at SurvivingTraumaticBrainInjury.com. That's all one word in all lowercase. And just click on the air show menu. There are two on the air there, so you want to hit the show menu one, on the air show menu tab. It's under the category section on the right sidebar. And it's really easy. And once there, you're going to find about 160, 170, 180 shows. I don't know how many are up there anymore. But there are a lot of shows, and you'll see the guests that I've interviewed, and you'll see all the different topics. So pick one. Pick one and start listening and see what you can learn. Because I can guarantee you're going to learn something from every show, from every guest that we have, or every panelist. So if you want to learn more about David or any other person that you hear about on the show, then just type the name in the search bar. So David Figurski, Figurski. If you put in David, you're going to find a few Davids up there from other areas of brain injury. So just type it in, and you might find something interesting that you want to listen to or read about. And if you want to type in about, maybe anger or depression, suicide, any of those, just put the word in, and you will, I promise you, get some feedback on some of those things. There are a lot of panels that talk about any one of those topics and more. You can read my complete story, I should say our complete story, in my book called Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, which was published by Right Life Publishing, and it was released in November of 2018. And you can find Prisoners, as I fondly call it, as a print book, an ebook, and as an audio book, which I was fortunate enough to be able to read. And I have to tell you, because this is kind of a little funny thing, but that audio book was put together, read in the middle of the night between 1 o'clock in the morning and 5 o'clock in the morning after the crickets went to sleep and before the birds came up in my kitchen. So yeah, but it's went through the audiographer, and it's really sweet. He did a wonderful, wonderful job on putting that book together. So yeah, check it out. And it's all, you can find the book at all your local book haunts, your Amazon, your Barnes & Noble, your Kobo, your independent bookstores. You can find it in the library too. And if it's not in any one of those, ask for it. They can easily retrieve it for you within a day or two. So, yeah, order it online. It'll come right to your house. So go to my website, DonnaFigurski.com, to learn more about me. And I want to just add this, too. When you do read my book, don't forget to write a review. Because a review is a book's best friend. And that's one of the best ways to let others know about a good read. So tonight, I hope that you're going to find my show fun and informative. And I hope that you'll visit the shows of the other hosts on Brain Injury Radio. There are shows most every night between 7 and 10 p.m. Pacific time. And you can also tune in at 5:30 p.m. Pacific time on the weekend to listen to your favorite shows, too. Put us on your calendar. Brain Injury Radio airs across the United States in every state, including Alaska and Hawaii, and in 36 different countries around the world. So now, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Tonight, my guest is Dana Lighty Hockenjoff, and I think I said that right. Am I correct?
You did. I'm impressed. Both of them.
Yay. Good. I know that. It's not the way I would have said it, but I read your book and I saw it. So I didn't cheat. I really found out. So yeah. And I have it phonetically written here too to make sure I said it correctly. So anyhow,
I don't think
Dana is
anybody's gotten the book.
You don't think anybody's got Say that again?
No, I said nobody has pronounced them both correctly on the first time, so I am truly impressed.
Okay. So, okay, let me explain and tell you a little bit about Jana and why she's here tonight. Jana was new to her teen years and facing the excitement and the angst that those years bring. You can go back. I don't know who's listening out there, but if you're beyond the teen years, you're probably saying, thank goodness I made it through. But high school, new friends, swimming, water skiing, dating, parties, and mall crawling are some activities that most teens look forward to. And they're almost a rite of passage. But when Jana's father was a passenger in a horrific car accident that turned his life upside down, it upended her life too, and her mother's. Weeks into her father's hospital bed, not knowing if he would ever wake, not knowing if he would ever be the same father again, Jana and her mother spent months in the rehab hospital, cheering her father on, urging him to walk, to talk, and to join the active living world again. I know what that feels like, and I did the same thing with David when he was had his brain injury in 2005. Just, you know, you're living in the hospital with your loved one, and you are just encouraging them and trying to get them back to you. And anyone who knows anything about an injury to the brain knows that the survivor is in for the long haul. We usually don't know that, though. Not in the beginning. Not in the beginning. We just think, oh, well, I'm going to just tell you. When David was transported by ambulance to the hospital, the paramedics, now this sounds really stupid, folks, I'm sorry. But I asked them if they, you know, when I said, can I ride in the ambulance with you, and or whether I should drive behind them, and I wanted to ride in the ambulance, I asked them, I said, well, would you be able to give us a ride home afterwards? They really, Donna? Come on. I know, but that's where my head was when this was happening. First off, I had no clue how serious it was. And secondly, no, paramedics are not going to drive you home, folks. Believe it. They were kind enough not to refuse me, but they didn't say yes either. But, oh, my God. So, anyhow, we know that, you know, it's going to be the long haul. It's not a sprint to health. It's really a very slow and steady marathon. And unfortunately, there is no guarantee of ever reaching the finish line. You know, doctors cannot tell us that. And what most folks don't realize is that a brain injury of a family member or a loved one affects not only the survivor, but also the extended family. Worlds change. It's obvious that the survivor's life would be drastically altered. But what is less known is that the lives of the family members are also radically reshaped as well. Think about the normal angst of teenagers for a minute here. Who will I sit with at lunch? Will I have a date to the spring fling hop? Will I pass my algebra test? Or will my crush even notice me at the Friday night football game? Those are heavy-duty worries for early teens. Now, mix in a parent with a brain injury. Worrying about juggling homework with hospital visits, you might be able to guess what life is like with a survivor of brain injury as a teen. I know I can make all kinds of guesses, but let's talk to Jana to get a real glimpse of living with a father with a brain injury. Before I even want to get into that, it's all right, I'm going to get into it after. Okay, so I'm going to say, welcome, Jana, and I'm really, really glad that you're here tonight, and we're going to be able to chat together for the next hour and a half. Hi, how are you?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing well.
Good. I'm so glad you're here.
I'm not a teenager anymore, so I'm doing okay.
No, you're not, but could you relate to those things that I was talking about?
Yeah.
The dance? Oh, my God.
I was very familiar.
Yeah, who am I going to sit with at lunch? Oh, my God, my best girlfriend is out sick today. What am I going to do? You know, those
are
real.
It sounds so 90.
I know. But, you know, I bet there's still a lot of that going on now, too, with kids. in those early teens. The Friday night football game, they still have them. You know, who's gonna be there? You know, all of those things are kind of universal, I think. And just say about
I have
things.
A niece, and I have a niece, and she's 12, and her life doesn't seem all that different in some ways.
Yeah, I think no. I mean, they have a lot of different things. I think they have a lot more stresses with the cell phone and internet and
that
kind of stuff, because everybody knows everything about everybody and tells everybody, you know. So they probably have a lot more stress than I had earlier than you, and even you had back in the late 90s as a teenager.
Yep.
So, yeah. So even though, Jenna, you're no longer a teenager, you're no longer living at home, you are a wife and mother now, and the author of a book titled Never Liked Cake. I'd like to walk you back several years to when you were that teenager, facing not only the turbulent adolescent years, but living through your father's brain injury. But even before that, so we're going to get to that part. But I want to go back even a little bit farther. I want to go back before we even take this journey of the teenage years and after your father had his brain injury. But can you tell our audience, let's go back, skip back those 2 years to your preteen years. And can you tell the audience what your life was like with your family before your father was involved in a car accident that changed, as I said earlier, not only his life, but yours as well, and your mom's? And what were you like as a child and as a preteen?
I would say, I was an only child, so I had a very close relationship with my parents. I always feel very, very lucky for that. And I don't know, my worries were, like, who my best friend was and where a sleepover was happening and my outfits. I definitely worried a lot about if I had a good outfit for school. I just started playing volleyball. My life was pretty good. I grew up in a really small country town in western PA, so I wasn't driving yet. I had some friends that were. It was simple. It was good. We stirred up drama when we thought that was appropriate to feel important.
Yeah. You know, and I have to tell you, I don't know if we mentioned this before earlier, not today, but in our emails, but we were almost neighbors. I grew up in Erie, Pennsylvania. And what is that, maybe 20, 30, 40 miles away from you?
Wait, can you ask that again?
Yeah, I said I grew up in Erie, Pennsylvania. And I think
that's only an hour. An hour north of where I'm from.
Right. That's what I thought, because we would always drive.
Yeah.
The Mercer was like way down to Pittsburgh.
Yes,
and
it's right between
Pittsburgh
and Erie. My mom liked Erie a lot, so we went up to Lake Erie, and we just go up for the day. We go to Presque Isle. We would eat out on the water, and then we'd just drive back down.
Yeah.
It was as close
to
the ocean as we could get, even though it wasn't the ocean, but it had waves and a tide, so it worked.
And you couldn't see across. It looked like an ocean. I always thought it,
sufficient.
I was only a mile away from it. I got quite a lot, so that was part of my upbringing. My childhood was the beach and everything. And it was interesting. You said that, one of the things you worried about as a teen was your outfits for school. I didn't to deal with that because I went to, and at the time, of course, I just had the outfit. I mean, I could choose. But when I look back on it, boy, was that easier not having to worry about it.
Right? We would actually always talk about that. We're like, I had a best friend and I, you'd think like, would this just be easier with uniforms? Or would we find a way to, like, make one uniform cool and make one, like, I don't know what we were trying to be. But I did always wonder if you just got to get up and just wear what you had to and move on with your day.
and then not have to think about it, you know? So I think in retrospect, because once I went back, once I graduated, of course, and finished college and went to work, and I was, you know, I was a teacher, so I was choosing my outfits every morning, and I was like, oh, God, why don't they just use uniforms now? And of course, when I went, I didn't want it, but it would have been so much easier than having to figure out, oh, no, it's in the wash. You know, so But
in high school, I spent a lot of time getting ready in the morning. Like, I laugh about that now because I get ready in like 2 seconds, and I think back of my mornings before just getting on the bus. They were just so long and drawn out, and so much hair and stuff and makeup and fixing and checking. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, back in the 90s, yeah, absolutely. You're probably my daughter's age, and I remember that. Yeah, so getting the hair ready.
You can put your hair in a ponytail, but I did it until it was completely perfect. And now I don't care.
Because you're wiser. You're older and wiser. But never convince is either that they'll think this way one day. They'll get there. There's hope.
Yes, there is.
So anyhow, before your teenage years, what was it like once your dad had his brain injury? You were just going into ninth grade then, which is a really exciting time, but like, again, one event tending to, oh, my God, you know, what do I do? Will I find myself? All of that kind of stuff again. And I don't know where you were in the smaller. Did you have small high school or was it a larger one? Encompassed the
We had a very small high school. My graduating class was 99.
Okay, yeah. Mine was 150. So yours was smaller than mine was.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, but still, you're still concerned. Probably a lot of the kids came from grade school with you and you knew them. But it's still, it's a whole new ball game that you're up there with, you know, because you're the big kid now, you know. You're in high school.
Yeah.
So so you're worrying about that. And then right that summer before is when your dad had his accident. Can you talk about time and how it was for you and your mom and just whatever there?
Well, the summer before, it was, I'm trying to think of how I can describe it because it obviously wasn't typical, but looking back on it, it was just the thing that was happening and there wasn't any sort of fighting it. And so I was just there for it. Like, everything took a back seat. Like something that felt so big, it may be worrying about going into ninth grade or what was important or what my classes would be or who I'd sit by. Like, that just sort of dissolved because this just took over our lives in such a way that in the beginning days, it was still a question of whether he would live, whether he would survive. Then it was the question of what would he be like? And then it was the question of what do we do? So there was always, it was a very busy time, even though it felt like a time of waiting. And it was a time for me that I remember two things very poignantly. And one was the day after my dad's accident, and it was a really close family friend of ours who was a psychologist who I just thought was so cool anyway. And the work that he did I thought was so cool. He told me, I remember we were sitting in the waiting room at the hospital, and he told me that my dad was going to be very different if he lived, and to remember that this isn't my whole story. I have a whole other story. This will be a part of my story, but it's not my whole story. And that always stuck with me. And what also stuck with me at that time, that summer before school, was that I kind of had this choice and I could make my life easier for my mother and my parents and do everything I could to help out and to be there and to not make anything difficult for them in terms of what I had control over. Or I could just say, screw it, this is your thing, I have my life, I can go party and be with my friends and not care. And, well, I chose the first choice because I didn't really see it any other way. And I think that making that decision for myself, for whatever reason, really did shape how I grew up into being a teenager and a young adult in a way that I may not have. I'll never know, but I know that's what I chose, and I don't regret that.
No, I think the parents wouldn't regret that either. You know, those are, think about as a 13, 14 year old. But you know, you were very intuitive about what you needed to help your mom. In your book, I felt that you were really concerned about her. You were sort of worrying about her as well as that. It wasn't just her. I mean, I never really heard anything of what my co-author friend and I call woe is me, you know, being so sad or, oh, look at me, I can't do this, I can't do that anymore. I never saw any of that in the book, and that was really to commend you on, you know, because a lot of people at that age, I mean, teenagers with a perfect life going have a difficult time, you know?
Yeah.
We know that. And you have to go through what you were going through, and for you to come out with it like that, with those kinds of thoughts, like, I have to, you know, you can take that slippery slope and go down and do all the things that you wanted to do and party and be an extra burden to your mom. Your dad wasn't so much aware at that point. But how would that have been that it would have? But I think a lot of kids wouldn't know that. I don't think they would be able to perceive that kind of stuff going. So I think maybe, and I'm just guessing too, as I said earlier, I'm guessing on a lot of things, but the relationship that you had with your parents beforehand, obviously, was a good one and solid one that you were able to, you know, hang tough there and do what needed to be done to help out in anything. Now, I'm not saying it was easy, because I know that it wasn't. It's got to be horrible.
No.
And it's almost where you could, and you would be justified in thinking, I'm losing my whole teenage years. I'm losing my whole life to something else. And that's not what you're supposed to be doing, sitting in a hospital, watching over your pop. You know, you're supposed to be out there, you know, your friends, you know, growing up and living and taking those extra little chances. So it was really, I commend you for doing that. It was really, you know, inspiring.
Thank you, because I don't know as though anyone's shared that or pointed that out to me before. So thank you.
Really?
Well, I don't think
so. You know,
so.
Because people, you're not in this world, you don't think of it that way. I mean, when people are not in the brain injury world, they don't really understand what the extended family is going through, what they're giving up in their lives to make it work this new life, you know? And some people do it. Some people can do it. Some people can't. And I'm not pointing any fingers at anybody for that or blaming anybody, because it's hard. It's very difficult to deal with that. And I know with your dad, you know, well, this is another question I have down there. And maybe I should, I think I'll just jump right into that. Let me go to those notes just to see. I'll go back. Because I know that he was difficult once he got home. His personality changed. So I'm probably going to be backtracking on some of the things I say, so I apologize for that. But, you know, he was a different person from what you described to me in the book earlier. You know, I saw him as a different type person before his brain injury, and then a completely different person after his brain injury. And those kinds of things, that's common. That's very common. Mm-hmm. And, well, I'm going to go into this part, because you said that one thing in your book is that I was too scared to hug my own brain injured father. And I went, oh, my God, that's a pretty sound statement. And it's one that many loved ones, family, and friends feel when they reacquaint themselves with their survivor. And just a little story here to justify what I'm saying here is I remember the first night that David came home from the rehab hospital. And he had been gone from our home for 3 months. When he got in that ambulance that I mentioned earlier, he was in the hospital between three hospitals, one rehab, two other hospitals, for 3 months. And I was by his bedside for 3 months. I was with him probably 14 to 16 hours a day, and sometimes more than that too. But I was there with him. So I was comfortable enough hanging out with him in the hospital while he was in coma, while he was trying to get himself back, while he was trached, when he was untrached and his voice was garbly and I couldn't understand him. But when he came home, I was afraid to sleep in the same bed with him. And I think I've told him this before. If not, he's having a revelation right now. But I think he knows this. But I was really afraid. He seemed so frail. David was like 150 pounds when he went in. So he's not a big guy to begin with. But he came home at 100, I think it was 125, 130 pounds. So he was frail, and he looked breakable. And he also didn't seem to be the same person that he was before the injury. And it took some getting used to. But, you know, finally I did become comfortable with the new version of David. But, again, I know that, you know, from your book, I know that you lived with a new version of your father. And did you finally adjust? And how was your life after your father first got home? And did you ever become completely comfortable with your post-injury dad? I know that's a lot of throw at you, but how did you adjust? How was your life when he first got home? And then as the years went by, did you become comfortable with him?
I think... I relate to everything you're saying about how when David first came home, and I feel my mom felt a lot of that, and she hid a lot of that from me. But I think it's sort of just this inevitable feeling, because you bring two worlds together. You have this world at the hospital where the bad things are happening, and you're trying to fix them, and you have hope, and you have all this. And then this reality happens when you bring that person from that world home, and it's not the home they were in the last time they were there. And it's just such a, like, a jarring experience. And it's just sort of a disconnect. Like, you have to sort of figure out how to put this family back together around this person that isn't, like, the puzzle piece that used to fit so well.
Exactly.
When my dad came home, I would say I found a very logical myself that was able to say, okay, this is how I take care of him. These are rules I have. Don't expect him to be your father and you to be the daughter. He's a person you love. He's your dad that you love, but this is all different. So don't put the expectation on it that you're going to do all the same thing. So I just, you know, kind of learned how to take care of him in the capacity that I could. Things like he can't drive, or, you know, make sure to a degree it was babysitting if it was just he and I home alone, because he wasn't able to do things for himself at the time in an independent way. He could eat, he could walk, he could, you know, fix himself something easy to eat, things like that. But he couldn't just go take the car somewhere or go, I don't know, mow the grass or things like that. And so a lot of the first times of him and I at home were me telling him what to do and him having to listen. And those were some of the ugliest moments of my life. They were such big fights, and I just had to sort of compartmentalize that this was his injured brain that was so upset with me or saying these things to me, and it wasn't my father, and it wasn't how he felt about me. And And I think I knew that when I was there with him in those moments, my mom wasn't, so she was getting a break. And I could do that for her. But at the same time, I also had a life where I went to my friends' houses and they didn't come to my house anymore. And I can remember the time I had a friend that my mom trusted, her mom, because they knew each other, they were friends, and I knew my dad, and she was the first friend I had come over after the accident. And it was just such a nerve-wracking day, and I was just hoping it would go okay. I wanted him to remember her name and how important she was to me, and this was my best friend, and I'd been spending all of this time at her house. And when my mom was at the hospital or after volleyball games, or just she became much more a part of my life as a result of the accident, because I was still a kid. So my mom wanted to trust me with someone by myself. And she came over, and I remember standing in the driveway, and we had like our matching volleyball windbreakers on, and my dad called her the wrong name. He wasn't very nice to her. He turned around and walked away from us. And I was like, well, okay, this is what it's like when my friends come over now. And there was just so many things that I thought would be the way my high school years would be with the parents I grew up with that just weren't. And I knew if I would dwell in that too much, I would be creating my own misery. But I had friends, I had my health, I had pretty good grades. I could do things for myself, and I could find okay moments in my days, because at home it was hard. It was hard, it was sad, it was scary at times, it was uncertain. I did a lot of writing in my journal. And when I went to school, my thinking, which I think was sort of the evolution of those hard choices I made over the summer, was that I couldn't go to school with this on my sleeve. Like, now my dad has a brain injury. I didn't want teachers to treat me differently. I didn't want students to, like, look at me and think, oh, yeah, like, that's that summer story. That's what happened to Jana. Like, I did not want that at all. And people would say things to me and they would feel so sorry for me. And they would, there was this phrase, and I know it's in the book and I can't remember it now, but people would say it to me and I hated it because I just felt so pathetic in a way. And I would tell myself, this is my story, but all these people, all these friends and classmates, they might have hard stories happening at home too. They might have things they don't talk about. And that kind of, even in my adulthood, kept me in the perspective of, like, this is really, really, really hard or sad or scary or whatever adjective, but you don't know what's going on in other people's lives. So I never got to a place where I was like, well, this is the saddest story you've ever heard. I win.
Yeah, right. You know, I don't want to win this one. Please say goodbye.
No.
I know what you mean.
No.
Yeah. I have, that just brought to mind one of the things. So people would say to me, because when I would, they would learn the story of David, who had 3 brain surgeries in less than 2 weeks, just out of the blue, because he was doing, and he had a subarachnoid hemorrhage. And then, and I would say, he had a one chance of living, okay? So he made it. But then people would say to me, oh, you're so lucky. And I'm like,
oh,
what?
That's what the phrase was. Yeah, that's exactly what they say. You're so lucky. I wanted to punch people.
So
can't do that at school.
Yeah. No, I put on a book trailer. I have a slide that goes, Fox would have never been to have a brain injury at all. Would have been lost. Yes, we're fortunate that David's alive. There's no question. And I understand what people are saying by it, too. I know what they mean.
Yeah.
They mean well. They're lucky to that this happened. But, like, I'm looking at it in a different lens than you are, you know, than these people are. And I could have been to never have had injury.
Yeah, and so many of my classmates. And I get it, too, because even looking back to the the emotional level of people that were my age, they would just be like, oh, at least he didn't die, right? So he's good. And I would be like, you have no idea. Yeah, he's great. Super great. I'll see you at lunch. Like, it was just kind of like, I'm not getting into this with you.
I know. I understand what you're saying there, too. Because they just don't understand. They can't. I mean, look, I was a bit older, and so was David, when he had his brain injury. We were in our 50s. So you can see the calculations of math, but I kind of try to avoid that. But anyhow, so, I mean, I've been around the block a few times. I know what's going on in the world. But boy, did I not know about brain injury. I had no clue about that and no clue that it was going to be what it was to get us to where we are right now. And one of the things I always think about, too, is I'm looking through my notes real fast, too, because I'm going to talk about this. But the thing is, I think what you're saying is when people say to you how lucky you are or, oh, wow, your dad didn't die, so good, you know? But I think the biggest surprise to folks about brain injury is that there is no definitive path to healing. And, for example, okay, a doctor diagnosed a virus or a common cold as lasting a week or two and healing a bone, a broken arm or a leg will take about 6 weeks after the cast is applied, okay? But doctors have no timeline for brain injury. Can't go in there and do a brain surgery and say, okay, it's going to be 3 weeks or 4 weeks, and then you're going to be all cold and everything's going to be fine. They can't even say it's going to be a year or 2 years or five because they have absolutely no idea how long it's going to take. And I'm sure, and I know that the doctors weren't able to explain it to you. And since you were 10 years even earlier than I was when David had his brain injury, you know, they knew less at that point. So my question now is, what were your thoughts about your father when the doctor tried to explain his brain injury to you and your mom? And were you able to wrap your head around what was happening in your family? I mean, that's hard enough for an adult to do, but as a kid.
I wanted to learn everything. I remember that. Like, I wanted to learn, where is it bleeding? What are you doing? What can you do? And we didn't talk about brain injury in 1996. It was head injury.
Right.
And it was, a lot of the difference was the swelling and understanding. You want the swelling to go down, and then kind of this, we were given a timeline. Well, we were given a trajectory and sort of this timeline. And the trajectory was, because my dad was comatose, so we went from not knowing any sort of cognitive abilities that would return for him, such as, you know, just speech or language or, you know, math, like things you don't think about as a kid, your dad not being able to do. And then also motor skills were a big deal. And then his memory was a big thing that was kind of like, oh, so is he going to forget everything? It's just like amnesia. Like, you know, you get hit on the head, and that was sort of the storyline, is that just make sure you can remember everything. And I began to realize it was so much more than just memory. But so I just wanted to learn about all these different parts of the brain. And then the only point of reference that I had was that a couple weeks before my dad's accident, we watched a movie called Regarding Henry. And I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, but it's with Harrison Ford. And Harrison Ford is this, and he's like a lawyer or something. I don't know. And he just is always working, and he's never home with his daughter and his wife, and he's, you know, grouchy and stressed and all these things. And then he slips and falls on the ice or something, or he's shot. Ugh, I don't remember. But he has a brain injury. And in his brain injury, he becomes this affable, positive, nice, loving family man. And I remember thinking, like, well, my dad's not regarding Henry, so we're going to have to do this a little differently because that's not how this is shaping up to be. But as far as the timeline, what we had been told by doctors was if things haven't changed in 2 years, they're not going to. So there was always this two-year mark, like what can improve in 2 years? How much can we get back in 2 years? And then there was a point that things started to, meaning he didn't necessarily keep on this upward trajectory of healing, they say, or getting back to his old self. And then we kind of had an idea of the real, like, parts of his brain, like where his brain was injured the most. And for him, it was the frontal lobe and it was personality. And that was hard because in the world of anyone that knew anything about brain injury, it was so much of like motor skills were gone or a cognitive skill was gone. But this was like, no, my dad can walk and he can still do math if he wants to. And, you know, he could, but he can't make good decisions and he's not that kind. So what now?
Mm-hmm.
And that's executive function. It's just our part of the brain that is about human reasoning. And it's incredible what it's like to operate your life without that functioning.
I know. You just have no way to make it. I think it's almost like common sense is gone there.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I've never seen that because I've done a lot of reading on this stuff too, but I haven't seen anyone say that. But to me, that's what it sounds like. It's, we have a friend, a professor's friend from Brigham Young, who had a brain injury right around when David had it, or maybe before David had it. And we met him up at a conference in San Diego, and he was explaining his injury to us, and it was executive functioning. And at the time, and he was a molecular biologist in that area field. And he would give his lectures every year, but he never wrote them down. Because it was innate, you know, in his head, he knew them. And then he had a fall, and it affected his executive functioning when he had his injury, and he no longer could remember his lectures. And because he had never written them down, they were gone for good, you know, and that's really sad. But one of the things he told us was, like he was in the yard and his grandchild was playing in the yard. And for some reason, he thought the child was in the street. Can't explain why, you know, but that's what the brain was playing the trick. I think that. And he was all scared and getting all panicky because the child was in the street when in fact the child wasn't in the street. So those are, you know, really weird, tricky things that your brain does with an injury. And one of the things that I've learned since David's brain event in 2005 is that every injury, well, I always say this, every injury is completely different from anyone else's injury.
Uh-huh.
They're like snowflakes. Most two injuries that are like, any injury is determined by the location and the severity of the damage to that part of the brain, whatever part is being affected. And the brain is made up of several called lobes, and you were saying that you had done some studying there, and your father had difficulty with his frontal lobe, which makes sense. He was in a car accident. He probably, I'm guessing again, you know, he hit his head against something, and it was probably a forward hit.
Hit his head against the other guy's head.
Oh,
figure that one out.
Nice. That's, wow.
I know. The other guy walked away perfectly fine.
I know. Yeah, I know. That's crazy, isn't it? And that's
so
just
crazy.
Another thing, too. But each of those lobes, there are four lobes in the brain. There are a lot of different parts. There are three major parts of it. And in the cerebrum, there are four lobes. And the frontal lobe is what you just talked about a little bit. And that's housed near the front of the head. It's behind your forehead. So if you put your hand up on your forehead, and right behind there, you're gonna, that would be where your frontal lobe is. And that lobe is responsible for language. It's responsible for cognitive thinking and motor function. Any damage in the frontal lobe will cause mayhem with emotions, behavior, personality. And that's one of the things, Jana, that you mentioned right away, is that father's behavior and his personality changed drastically from what he was prior to his injury. Fortunately for us, David didn't damage that part of his brain. And I'm really, really grateful for that. The temporal lobe, again, now is, I'm sorry, God, where is the temporal lobe? See how many times I look at these pictures so I know them, and I looked at them again today, but I don't remember. Anyhow, the temporal lobe processes, I know what it does, I just can't remember the exact thing in the brain. I could probably look it up really fast. I will. And then I can be accurate in telling people what we're talking about. But it processes the language, memories, and hearing. Brain. Whoops, spell it right if I want to get some images. I want to get some pictures. Okay, so and it helps to your hearing and your visual perceptions. It works on that. And it helps to internalize visual stimulation. And David was spared the damage in that section too, fortunately, you know, so we don't have that. It would be uncomfortable. I think the frontal would probably be more damaging, but not sure since, no, he doesn't have it. The occipital lobe, which is, I think that's right at the top of your head, like at the crown of your head, if I'm right. My computer is not coming up with the images. But
I think the occipital lobe is near the occiput, so I think it's at the base, like closer to the base of your brain, like in the center, but I could be wrong too, and I don't have the internet where I am, so I can't even try to play the game. But
yeah, find the parts of your brain. Oh, darn, my computer is so slow. Okay, so it's not coming up. But I think it's like at the crown, but lower, you know, right where you put your hand, if you put your lean back on your head, I think that's where it is. I think the temporal is on the side. Okay, but that's not helping anybody when I don't know for sure. So let's go beyond that. So anyhow, his occipital lobe wasn't damaged either. It must have been damaged. Because that's a vision thing, and his vision was seriously damaged. And David sees double, tilted, and blurry. So he was using prism glasses and everything. The parietal lobe processes the sensory information like smell and touch. And David has no problem with smell or touch sensations. And then there's the cerebellum. Now, it's not one of the lobes, but it is another part of the brain, and it is located, and I know where this one is. It's located at the base of the skull. So if you put your hand right back at the very bottom of your base of your skull, the top of your neck, then that's where your cerebellum is. It's very tiny, but it's very powerful. And it's responsible for, they're telling me that they can't. Oh, no wonder. In the Wi-Fi, that's crazy. Okay. That's the part where it takes care of the motor skills and walking, that sort of thing. And David has his balance challenged, and he has difficulty walking on his own. He can walk in the house on his own, but it's tricky. He does use a rollator now. At one point, he was able to walk on his own, but for safety reasons, because a fall would be devastating, he does use the rollator for extra balance in the house. But outside, he cannot walk. That's how severely damaged his cerebellum was. Now I know why I couldn't get on. There we go. Oh, yay. Okay, I'm going to get us a good picture of this, and then I can explain where it is, if I can find a picture now. That's not a good one. Okay, I'll keep talking a while. So anyway, one of the things I want to know is Did the doctor ever indicate to you and your mom which areas of your father's brain were impacted from his injury? Now, I know you said the frontal lobe. Did he have any other parts
of
his brain that were damaged?
He broke his eye socket also on the left side, so it was the left frontal lobe, and his hippocampus failed at some point. So, yeah, the injury, though, was definitely the left frontal lobe, but the hippocampus was a couple weeks later. I'm not sure exactly why, but he ended up having to go back into the hospital after he was in rehab, so... There was a lot of swelling, but that was the, I would say, why can't I think of it? Just like the main point, that's not what I mean, though. Just the frontal lobe, that was the point of impact.
Okay, yeah. All right, so, yeah, so it just depends where it is. So, I mean, if somebody, David's injury, well, we're not sure where it actually happened, but where the stress must have been most was probably in the cerebellum. What he was doing was chin-ups. So he did 13 chin-ups that particular morning when he usually only did 12. So he stressed his body at an extra level at that point. And that's David. That's just the way he is. He always has to do better than he did before. It's just who he is. And I even have to pull him back now sometimes, like, hey, just, you know, stop. You don't have to do this extra whatever you're doing. You don't have to work the extra hour or whatever. You know, it's okay. I'm sorry, I'm just laughing because my pup just walked in here and she's looking in the mirror and pawing at herself. And she's going, like, who is that pup in the mirror? It's so funny. But anyhow, yeah, so, you know, I think he's, you know, getting better at that, but it's always been that way his whole life. Just to outdo yourself, you know, you can do better. You can always do better. But this time, work, you know, because that it's just where he had the subarachnoid hemorrhage. He had an aneurysm. He had an AVM, a tangled. They found a tangled blood vessels up there. So that was the three different surgeries. But it was a subarachnoid hemorrhage. It was the bursting of the bleed in his head. It just was too much. So that little chin-up changed the entire course of our lives. So, and you just, you know, you never know. It's somebody else who you see all those people in the gyms that are pushing themselves, and I'm like, oh, please don't. You know, you don't need that extra muscle on your bicep, you know? You're definitely not. Don't do that. But, you know, people are always pushing, you know? I think we've learned a little bit through that. Let's see. I want to go back up and look at some notes where I skipped some things. So I want to go back up and grab them. Oh, yes. Okay. In your book, Jenna, Never Liked Cake, you wrote about how confused you felt when school started after summer, and it seemed that you were torn between returning to school, which you were excited about, and what you felt was your duty to stay with your mom to help your dad. And I think that confusion caused conflicting feelings, and the guilt that is mixed in with them, you know, it's normal for you to have felt that way. But for a teenage girl with no one to talk to, it can be scary. And we both agreed that nobody much knew about brain injury back when your father had a brain injury in the late 90s. So, you probably had even less people to talk to than even I did, you know? I didn't have anybody to talk to either, but still, probably, you know, there was less known. We know that. There was less known back at that time.
Well,
so,
yeah. I remember what I had from the hospital that we went home with. They gave me a book called When a Parent Has a Brain Injury. And that was all I had.
Yeah. And did it do you?
And it was like a pamphlet. No, it was like a pamphlet. Mm-hmm. But I studied it and studied it. I was like, well, might be small, but I'm going to know how to do everything in this. And that kind of always stuck with me. And I just kept thinking, like, if nobody about having a parent with a brain injury, and all these kids, all they have is this pamphlet, and I'm going to have to write one someday.
Yeah. You know, that's funny because I had the same feelings when I was in the hospital. Now, David was in a smaller hospital in the beginning, and then we moved over to Columbia Presbyterian in New York, which is where David worked at the university. And I wanted him there with his with colleagues and the medical staff that was there, some of whom worked on him, we knew. So I remember being there, and that's a big hospital. And there was nothing for me. You know how you go into doctor's offices and you see pamphlets on Alzheimer's, or Parkinson's disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, diabetes, you see MS. Where are the pamphlets? You had one at least in Mercer, but
a nurse had to go dig it out. Yeah. It wasn't just readily available. It was like a random nurse at some point came and was like, I thought this might help. I'm not really sure. I don't even know where it came from.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It wasn't just there. Because my point was, I think I should make a pamphlet. Now, mind you, this is 18 years ago. Have I done it yet? No. But I feel like, why aren't there pamphlets in the doctor's office?
I don't know.
To explain, just like they do for anything else. So when you're sitting there waiting for a doctor forever, you know, it's brain injury. Oh, wow, that's interesting. Let me check it out. You know, I've read over the MS ones, I've read them over. When they're there, they look enticing, and you don't get a college class on it, but you do get snippets of what it's all about. It gives you some idea. You know, they might even show you the brain, and then I went to that to look it up.
Mm-hmm.
But you know
That's
what I
true.
Mean?
Yeah, people could learn something.
At that point, I did not think I would be writing a book. I was writing a book for children. That was my big thing. My big goal, my big dream still is today, is to get my children's books published. So I had no inkling or any idea or even thought I could possibly write a paragraph for adults to start a book, you know? But when I was in the hospital with David, I was taking notes. I had a journal and taking notes on everything that happened. You know, one day David waved. He finally, after weeks and weeks and weeks, waved to my cousin as she left. She said, bye, David, and he waved. You know, and that was monumental, and I wrote it down. And then that evening, I go home, and I write my update to all of the family members, which are spread all across the country. So I would, we call them the David updates, and I would write all of that down, and I would, as I send them out. So, of course, I put them all in a folder and save them all, too. Not for any reason other than that's what I was doing, you know, just to keep everybody informed. Well, then a year passed, and I start to write paragraphs or something on this. And I don't know why, because it wasn't a conscious effort. But I started to write something, and then I said, David, do you want to hear this? And he said yes, and he came into my office, and he sat on the floor, leaned against my couch, and I read him what became, I guess, the first chapter. And he goes, you know, you have to finish this. This is a book. You have to write this. And I laughed, of course, because I don't write for adults. I write for kids, and this is not a kid's book. So, but I started to, and it wasn't until I probably got 10, 12 chapters done that it became a serious project. And I went through it, and I think there were 70 chapters when I sent it in. I don't know how many there are now. We combined a lot. So when I sent it to the editor, she combined things. So anyhow, that's what came about. And again, I mean, I was thinking, just a pamphlet, that's all. I can do a pamphlet. That's like short, like a child's book. But no, I ended up doing a full book. And so because, again, for the same reason that you said, there wasn't anything out there. And I needed to be able to help people. I wanted to help people to see what, you know, what was going on with my life. And David was in a coma for weeks, and every time he'd start to come out of it, they'd give him another surgery and put him back in. So I couldn't even ask him, like, what am I supposed to do with? So we always consulted each other and helped each other out that way. So it was just really interesting, crazy what happened. But it's done. But I hope that people will be able to look these books up and get some use from them. Jana, today, what would you tell a teenager today that was going through a brain loss with one of his or her parents?
I would say this isn't your whole story. I would say it's part of your story, and you're going to have all these other amazing parts of your life that will not be as sad or as difficult or as uncertain or as scary, but there's also the side of it where even though this is something you didn't expect and it's probably not something you wanted at all, you will find parts of yourself and parts in your family in this experience that maybe you wouldn't have had you not been a part of it. The thing I can offer, which might be a ways out there, but it's really something that I came to later on in my 20s when I started practicing yoga and really starting my own healing process of the things that I went through as a result of this, is that you simply can't change it. So for all the internal fighting I was doing against what happened and what took my dad away and what changed my family and what hurt so much so often, is I could just stop fighting the reality of it and see it from a new perspective. And that was probably the most, the way I was sort of, I'd say halfway free from living with a dad with such a severe brain injury.
Yeah, I like that, that it is part of your story. I think, there was a doctor in the book, and I don't remember his name, but it began with a P, and I think that he was the one that told you that.
No, there was, his doctor was Dr. Pecorelli, who was amazing, but who told me that was my parents' family friend that I had mentioned earlier, but his name was Dr. Gallo, and he's the one that told me it's just a part of my story.
Okay, and what did the other doctor tell you? There was something really important. Let's write it down.
I don't know. Dr. Pecorelli's offered a lot to me. He's wonderful. I'm not sure what exactly.
I'm taking through right now. It should be in yellow, but I'm not going to waste time looking for it. But I thought it was really interesting. I thought, that's very brilliant. And I was hoping, and I didn't write it down. And I take all kinds of notes and mark up your book and make it look very, it's very pretty, very yellow. Oh, here it is. How do you feel? That's what he asked you. He just said, how do you feel? Because nobody was asking you that.
Oh, yes. Feel? That was
how
Dr. Peck, really. Yes. That was a poignant thing, because in this, and I don't mean to sound like a martyr in any way, but I would often put myself last because I thought when it came to my parents, I had the most opportunity ahead of me. So if I could take care of the things I could for them to the extent that I could, then I'd figure myself out later. So it was such a strange question to think about how I felt in the moment, because I didn't often at that time think of myself and how I felt in that moment.
Uh-huh. I wonder if that was an escape mechanism for you too, because, and I'm saying that I do.
Yes, it was.
I do that.
It certainly was.
Oh, okay.
And then I had to escape. I couldn't live through the things that I was experiencing, feeling them, I think, to the extent, because so much of it was a lot for as little as I was. And I really, like, I'm glad that I didn't try to figure it out then, that I took my time and I I had my own forms of, I don't even want to say being rebellious, but I decided, oh, well, I'm old enough and I don't trouble my mom anymore. I can go do what I want with my life and figure myself out. And in that and through my 20s, I did have to do a lot of work to process this life experience because there was a lot of times I blocked it because I wanted to have a high school life and I wanted friends and I wanted a boyfriend and I so craved normalcy. So I did the best that I could to create it until I had to face it. And I think I had to face it when I was old enough. When I was old enough to ask myself the question, how do you feel? Well, that was like a landslide of emotions. And my first thought was angry. I was so angry. I was angry it happened. I was angry it ruined my dad's life. I was angry it made my parents' life difficult. I was angry it took my mom's love of her life away. I was angry at something called ambiguous loss that nobody seems to understand, which is when there's a person who's still right in front of your face, but they're gone, or such a large percentage of them is gone, or a relationship you have with them is gone, and you grieve that, but yet how do you grieve something that's still right there with you?
Yeah, exactly. I just did a show on ambiguous loss with Norma Myers, and we talked about that because she had her two of her sons were in a car accident. One passed away, and one came out with a brain injury. You know, and so she's got that ambiguous. The son is there, but he's not. But he used to, you know, he's not anything like what he used to be. And so, it's something that people get and they don't understand. So that's so true. Well, I'm so glad I found this page. And I really, because what I do is I call myself the Energizer ostrich. I keep my head in the sand and just keep as deep as I can. And then that doesn't make me think about all the things that we're missing out in life because of David's brain injury. You know, and if I thought about all the, you could be angry, like you said. You could be really upset and angry and wallow in it. And where does that take you?
Right.
It doesn't get you anywhere. So, it works for me. I'm not saying it don't work for everybody, but it works for me. And so that's what I do. I have
and for a long
another
time, I did a lot of, like, running. Not running, but just I lived life at a really fast pace, and I was always going and moving and there was really only two things that have been able to slow me down, and one is my husband and the other is yoga. And when I had to slow down and really be present, it was extremely uncomfortable and it was frightening at first because I realized one of my fears, and I would joke about it, was, oh, what are your three worst fears? And I'd be like, I don't know, bears, spider webs, and happiness. And I, for so long, was afraid of happiness because it could go away and I didn't know how I could handle that again. And so I just didn't want to be that present to feel it. And it's something I still to this day have to be cognizant of.
Yes, I get that totally. It makes sense. And I bet you a lot of people do that. I just want to go into, there are two real things I want to go to. We're running out of time already. This just flew by. I wanted to talk about, at one point you wrote about how your mother stepped right into the role of caregiver. And your actual words, and I quote, she knows exactly how to be anyone's caregiver. And she was taking care of everything. Her kids, her husband, her mother, her employees, a boat, two houses, three cars, her horses, our dog, our cat, one cat, and my father's fish. Just never herself. And I went, wow. Because no wonder she never took care of herself, number one. She had no time. Mm-hmm. But I also understand that she was probably, I can completely relate from what I just told you before. When you keep overly busy, whether it's by choice or by demand, you don't have time to, you know, and your mom sounds a lot like me, minus a few things like horses and barn cats and fish. But there really is no choice. when one is thrown in the deep end of brain injury. Somebody has to step up. And I know that you were a big help to your mother just from reading about what you had never liked to take. And she was lucky to have you by her side. But did you ever talk to your mom about those early years, the weeks, the months, and even maybe years, or early days, I should have said earlier than years, after your dad's brain injury to find out how she managed? And what would you most like to know? Is there anything that is unanswered for you with that?
I mean, I talk to my mom about everything. Okay. I still talk to her about it. And I don't know if there's anything I would most like to know. I know there's a part of her now that my dad has died that feels like she can grieve someone she lost 26 years ago. And I know for a long time that was something that was really stuck, and she didn't really know how to do that, so she kept going too. And that grief has hit her hard. Like, I don't think she saw it coming in a way that I saw it coming, because I allowed myself to do that. But I always am very aware of the fact that, you know, this was my father, and this was, you know, her partner and her best friend and the love of her life. And I know that I would have a different way of coping with something if it was my husband, now that I have a husband and I understand that a little bit more. So I've never really expected anything of her, because I can't know what she's experiencing.
Right. Yeah. That's really
but
true.
I can be there for her, and I can talk about it. And I've always said to her, you know what, like, no matter like what you decide, I will support you. And I mean, that's pretty much how I feel. And